From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Negative partisanship has a major impact on today's political debates. Jonah Goldberg of National Review joins us. He explains why that's bad news for all Americans. State lawmakers have hired outside investigators to look into a controversial fund. It's tied to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. You'll learn more about the investigators' work. Supporters of electric vehicles tout potential environmental benefits, especially for air pollution. But you'll hear from a UNC Chapel Hill economics professor who challenges their claims. Plus, we'll assess a major enrollment slowdown in North Carolina's largest public school system. What could it mean for state education policy? Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
On January 1st, North Carolina's income tax rates went down, which means that working North Carolinians will keep more of what you earn. Now, the tax cuts are part of a multi-year reform effort by the Republican-led General Assembly to overhaul how the state treats taxpayers and also how the state is positioned to attract new people and new businesses. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. She has been following this multi-year effort very closely and joins us now with the latest. Becky, welcome back to the program.
Thank you,
Donna.
Happy
New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you, too. Thank you.
The first component of this new package that went into effect January 1st is one that isn't, unfortunately, getting a lot of media coverage, but it's really consequential, and it has to do with something called the zero tax bracket. Help us understand that.
Well, you know, Don, I agree with you. This is one of the most significant things. It's not getting enough attention. This is where people don't pay any taxes. It's a certain percentage of your income that right off the top, you don't pay any taxes on it. We've heard all this talk, this rhetoric from the left about the tax cuts have only been for the rich. It's only for big corporations. Well, this zero tax bracket and the increase in that, this is the standard deduction, has increased. And this impacts lower income folks much more. There are close to 400,000 North Carolinians under this new plan that goes into effect on January 1st who will pay no North Carolina taxes. So, I mean, this is huge. This is huge not only for the lower class, but the middle class. And it's one of the most significant tax cuts that they've had. Now, in addition to that, as you mentioned in the introduction, there's a reduction for personal income tax across the board. There's also a reduction in the corporate income tax. So these rates continue to go down. And what we've seen with this, as you mentioned, people get to keep more of their money. And what that means is people either put money in savings or they buy things. This is what drives the economy. And at the same time, reining in the spending that's happening at the government level is what has resulted in this economic growth that we've seen in North Carolina.
Between then the increase in the standard deduction or this zero tax bracket and also then the decline of the personal income tax rates, you've got a lot of individuals, a lot of families who are going to have more money in the paycheck and more money once they file their tax return
absolutely.
As well.
And yeah, along that line too, Don, let me just mention real quick that a lot of small companies file under the personal income rate. So yes, it's families and individuals across North Carolina, but it's also those small mom and pop operations. This is such a boon to entrepreneurs, to small business people. We hear all this, and this is what makes the big media headlines is Apple, Google, these big companies that North Carolina is spending are trying to give away all this money to lure them there. These relatively small tax cuts have tremendous impact on day-to-day businesses, on the mom-and-pop businesses, on the people that really do make North Carolina's economy run and work so successfully.
This type of reform has been going on for a number of years now. I can think back to when I first moved to North Carolina more than 15, 16 years ago. There was a multi-tiered, really confusing tax structure. I never understood it, frankly.
Personal income tax, right.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that has all changed. And so there's been a number of different efforts, and they just keep coming from the General Assembly.
They do. And, you know, that's why this last election makes so much difference. That's why it matters who is sitting in those leadership positions at the General Assembly. You know, in my view, what we want are fiscally responsible, conservative leaders who understand that people who earn the money are in a better position to spend that money. And of course, we have core functions of government that we want to be funded, but we need to watch those dollars very carefully. And we need leaders who understand that the money they're spending is not theirs. It doesn't grow on a tree behind Jones Street. It belongs to North Carolinians like you and I and so many of our listeners.
Now, part of the changes for 2019 involves a reduction in the corporate income tax rate as well. And that one is pretty consequential. But I got to tell you, Becky, already there's some pushback in some media venues that are saying, well, that's just a giveaway to the rich. All those people who are running those corporations, they don't deserve it.
Well, let me remind you of the standard deduction that we've had. You know, that's where those people that make those claims really aren't looking at the entire tax picture. But the corporate tax rate went from, in 2011, when we started this, that corporate tax rate was 6.9%, one of the highest in the country. Now, not every state charges a corporate income tax rate at all, but of those states that do, North Carolina was one of the highest. And this is a real impediment for corporations coming to North Carolina. As we've reduced that, we've seen all this economic growth, again, tied to lots of things, reduction in regulation, less government, smarter government spending. But as that tax rate goes down, it makes it more attractive for companies to come here. Again, started at 6.9%. Before this most recent reduction, it was 3%. It now goes down to 2.5%, which, Donna, is the lowest of any corporate tax in the country of states that have a corporate tax.
That's,
so again, we're a leader in
that's
this.
That's got to mean then that companies around the country or even around the world who are looking for a place to either expand or to move a headquarters, that's got to get their attention.
Exactly. And companies within North Carolina are now able to keep, again, you know, we talk about with lower personal income tax, families being able to keep more of their money. Corporations now are able to keep more of their money and make investments in their businesses, whether that's to buy a new computer, whether that's to buy a new delivery truck, or more importantly, whether that's to hire a couple more employees. And when you have that kind of economic energy that's going on, of more people being employed, there's less stress on welfare programs and those kind of things. People are able to take care of themselves and their families because they're working. And the reason why they're working is because companies and corporations are providing jobs for them. So all of this is tied together.
We know, as you've just referenced, that North Carolina's economy has been really humming along for several years now. If you want a job in North Carolina, in most cases, you can find a job if you've got some basic skills that folks are looking for. And with all this tax reform and the economic growth that we've seen in our state, it means now that other states are trying to figure out exactly how North Carolina did this. But you said something really interesting a few minutes ago. It's not just tax reform. You mentioned the issue of spending working hand in hand with this. Help us understand more about that.
Well, the taxes, the revenue that comes is only half of the equation. It's also, what do you spend that money on? And what other states have done, the mistake that they've made is they haven't gotten that balance right. And so as we have reduced taxes, we have also reined in the growth of government and the spending, looking at, okay, where are the core functions of government that I think we can all pretty much agree government needs to provide? Public safety, education, those kind of things, healthcare, you know, absolutely. But how do you do that in the most efficient manner? And how do you get rid of outdated programs, of duplicative programs? How do you make the best use of every federal dollar, which is tax money as well? How do you make the best use of that? How do you really take a look at how the money has been being spent? You do that in a very effective, efficient way. And you ask the question, is this a core function of government, or is this something that the private market perhaps can do? And when the private market does it, then they create jobs. And again, you have people employed and less pressure on government services. So it's all tied together. And Donna, another piece of this too are the regulations that are in place. What we find, and there's been all kinds of economic studies that have shown what the cost of regulation is on businesses, on individuals. And so really taking a good hard look at that and rolling back those regulations that are a barrier and an impediment. So when you put that whole formula together, and it's not just tax cuts, it's not just reining in the growth of government or really looking at spending by itself. It's not just the removal of regulations. All of that together is what has resulted in North Carolina's transformational economic situation that we have here.
Becky, thanks so much.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some conservatives want to persuade people that they pursue policies that will end up working best for society. Others just want to fight liberals. Jonah Goldberg of National Review supports the first group. He joins us now to explain why. So why not just battle our opponents?
I think one of the reasons why the conservative movement got into the cul-de-sac that it did is that it lost sight of this basic understanding of what politics is supposed to be about. It's supposed to, go back to Aristotle, it's supposed to be about persuasion, about convincing someone that their interests are better served by being a member of your coalition than somebody else's, than the coalition they're currently in. And instead, we emphasized purity, that we said that if anybody doesn't agree with us entirely, they're a squish or a rhino. Once you start emphasizing purity, on the left or the right, you are necessarily pushing away people who might agree with you on a lot and might be members of your coalition. Reagan used to say, if you agree with me on 7 out of 10 things, you're my 70% friend. You're not my 30% enemy. And one of the things that Reagan did not talk about being a conservative very much. He didn't talk about being a Republican very much. He talked about what he believed were universal or at least fundamental American values and tried to attract people to his arguments by making arguments and primarily by telling stories. If you go back and you watch Reagan's speeches, he illustrated his points by just telling stories. Sometimes they were kind of hokey and old-fashioned. Sometimes they were just funny jokes. But, you know, our brains are wired to understand things through stories. Most of our information for most of our time on this planet was conveyed through stories. The Bible is many things, but at its most basic level, it's a bunch of stories. Every important lesson you have in your life has a story attached to it. And storytelling, I'm not saying lying, I'm not saying fiction, but telling a story, a compelling story that opens people up to where you're coming from and, more importantly, where you want to go, is a much better way of doing politics than reading off a list of principles. And if you say you disagree with any one of the lists, anything on my list of principles, that you're a bad person or you're a traitor or you're wrong, doesn't really work very well. And so much of the problem that we have in our culture today, I don't want to get into the weeds on romanticism, but it's performative. We shout what we believe. We try to insult others to prove how great we are or how pure we are or how we have the right enemies.
Are you saying too many people are focusing on just trying to beat the other side?
One of my favorite New Yorker cartoons, which my wife had blown up and framed for me, has two dogs at a bar. And one dog is, they're drinking like martinis, and one dog says to the other, you know, it's not good enough that dogs succeed. Cats must also fail. And that's the essence of sort of our tribal politics these days, where we care less about winning, save as measured by whether or not it's making the opposition lose or feel like losers. And that has no limiting principle to it, which is why our politics continually get uglier and uglier because it's sort of like the junkie who just needs to keep upping the purity or of the dose or the quantity of the dose. We need to constantly mainline more outrage about how terrible the other people are or how unfair they're being to us.
That's the voice of Jonah Goldberg, senior editor at National Review and scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. How does civil society play a role in helping to address this problem?
What civilization is, sort of by definition, is a system that constrains human nature in positive ways, right? In a natural environment, the way you get what you want is if you have a bushel of apples and I want your apples, I hit you over the head with a rock and I take your apples. So that's why one of the first things that any civilization worthy of the name civilization does is regulate violence. Because in human nature, we see anybody outside of our group as fair game. And what a civilization does is says, no, 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 there has to be rules that everybody apply to everybody fairly, sort of the golden rule, do unto others. That is the way you regulate violence, that's the way you regulate behavior. As civilizations advance and mature and civilize, we set ever higher standards for our expectations of human conduct. This is one of the reasons why it drives me crazy when I hear parents tell their kids, just go with your instincts. You don't tell kids to go with their instincts. That's how they take your car keys and stick them into a light socket. The whole point of being a good parent is to teach kids not to go with their instincts. No hitting, right? Let go of your sister's hair. That is what we do when we civilize kids who just come with the factory preset programming of human nature. And institutions throughout human history have been doing this. We get the word nepotism from the Catholic Church. It means almost literally nephewism. And it comes out of the corrupt practice of archbishops and cardinals having affairs or having secret families and giving special jobs or special perks to their quote-unquote nephews. And nepotism is hardwired into us. There's never been a society anywhere in human history where people didn't give special preferences to their own offspring, never mind their family, their kin, their friends. Favoritism is natural. But we understand that a functioning society needs to hold that stuff at bay. The Chinese tried it and the Turks tried it by literally creating taking slaves and castrating them, thinking, okay, well, now they'll have no loyalty except to the state or to the sultan or whoever it is. But it turned out over time that that didn't even work because the janissaries and the eunuch bureaucrats formed their own sort of coalition or tribe and conspired against the state. The only real way that you can hold human nature at bay is by civilizing people, by teaching people from right from wrong. And when you don't do that, human nature comes rushing back in. That's the real source of corruption in life. That's the story of Lord of the Flies, right? Lord of the Flies, you got these little kids. They're the pinnacles of Western civilization. These little British schoolboy kids, boarding school kids. You drop them off on a deserted island with no adult supervision. And like 5 minutes later, they're running around with spears and war paint and worshiping some pagan god and trying to kill each other. That's one of the reasons why I love like zombie movies in a post-apocalyptic pop culture, because the second the thin veneer of civilization vanishes or suspends, people revert back to human nature, which is small nomadic bands of tribal people fighting in a zero-sum battle against other nomadic bands and zombies. And so when we see civil society break down, because that is where civilization happens, right? One of my favorite quotes comes from Hannah Arendt, where she says, every generation, Western civilization is invaded by barbarians. We call them children. And that's why Ronald Reagan said, we are never more than one generation away from tyranny, because we're not born with liberty in our blood. You have to fight for it in every generation and pass it on. But we live in a profoundly romantic period where we tell people that the highest source of moral authority isn't God, who you should be afraid of and is always watching you, but your own gut. Your own instincts. Stay true to yourself. Live by your own code and you're a good person. And when you teach people on a mass scale that they are the ultimate arbiter of right and wrong, that they are their own priests, it becomes much more difficult to get people to have a sense of what is good for the greater good or what is simply just right and wrong beyond a utilitarian calculus that says, if it's good for me or if it feels good, I'm going to do it.
That's Jonah Goldberg. He's senior editor at National Review and a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's identifying a key problem plaguing American politics today. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Lawmakers looking into a controversial fund tied to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline are hiring outside investigators. State Representative John Torbett.
My question is easy for the gentlemen, the professionals here in front of us today. Gentlemen, will you and can you search, find, and present the committee truth?
Certainly. We can certainly find the facts. Will we get the truth? We're certainly hopeful that's what all citizens do, is tell us the truth. Sometimes that's not the case, and we have to use our experience and do follow-up interviews with other individuals to get the truth and the facts. But that's our intention, is to gather the facts and report those facts, and hopefully that's the truth.
State Senator Harry Brown responded to a question about the investigation's cost.
If the governor had come forth with the information that we'd asked for in the past year, this would cost us nothing. You know, we have been asking over and over now for almost a year and have been completely stonewalled. We got a letter, a couple of weeks ago, saying that the information requested was coming. And yet we get a letter today that does the exact opposite of what we've been told was going to happen for months now. The exact opposite. And it's unfortunate because, I didn't want to have to go here. I didn't think we had to go here. And why this governor continues for now almost a year to completely ignore our request is beyond me. I just don't understand why he would do that. And You know, you've heard the terms pay to play and what's going on and why we ask for those records. If he just produced them, you'd end the conversation. You would know. And yet he has refused over and over and over to produce anything. We've not gotten one single request back from the governor in a year. Not one. And they ask us to do it in writing. We did it in writing. We've done everything they've asked us to do, and yet completely stonewalled. And yet today we get something from him asking for a record request from us, and we'll do that, and we're going to do it in a very timely manner. But again, all that tells me is it's just another delay tactic, and that's unfortunate. It's just so unfortunate we've got to be here, because it shouldn't cost anything. We shouldn't even have these gentlemen here today. But the governor's driving this train. He has made this choice for us, basically.
That's State Senator Harry Brown. He's explaining why he and his colleagues are hiring outside help to investigate a $58 million fund tied to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Advocates for electric vehicles argue that they're better for the environment than cars fueled by gasoline. Is that true? The answer isn't as simple as you might think. Andrew Yates is professor in the economics department at UNC Chapel Hill. He recently discussed the topic with the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society.
What's the environmental benefit of an electric vehicle? How do we define this? Well, suppose we have a person that's about to buy an electric car. They walk into the dealership, and they're about to buy a car. They walk into the dealership, and they're thinking, should I buy an electric car or should I buy a gas car? All right, we want to think about the consequences of that decision for the environment. So if they buy the gas car, they're going to generate some air pollution. We'll talk about that, how we calculate that. And if they buy an electric car, they're going to generate some air pollution from the electricity that's used to charge the car. So what we want to do is just compare those two numbers, right, and see which one's bigger. All right, if the electric vehicle produces less air pollution than the gasoline vehicle, then that's the environmental benefit, is the difference between those two numbers. Right? And so if you were a concerned citizen, you kind of want to know, you know, is this electric car good for the environment or not? You probably do a Google search. And if you do that, you would turn up some stuff, probably by the EPA or maybe the Union of Concerned Scientists. And most likely that information would be about the carbon dioxide emissions of an electric car versus a gasoline car. All right? And so that's interesting. And we will talk about the carbon dioxide emissions as part of the emissions from these cars. But it's not the whole story. Right? So generally speaking, and this is consistent with our results as well, there's a slight advantage if you only care about carbon emissions to having an electric car versus a gasoline car, right? But what we do in our study is that we focus on these other pollutants, these things called local pollutants, right? Carbon dioxide is a global pollutant, generally affects everywhere in the world the same way. Or a local pollutant, it really matters where that pollution gets emitted, as we'll see. And so these are pollutants like sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, particulate matter, and volatile organic compounds. Right? And so what we're going to see here is it really makes a difference where the car is driven, how severe these pollutants are. Right? And so it can be important because it can reverse the sign. Right? So if you just cared about carbon, say electric vehicles on average are a little bit better, than gasoline vehicles, but we can reverse that, and as we'll see, we can reverse that significantly if we start worrying about some of these other pollutants.
Yates used a map to illustrate his point.
Green is places in which an electric vehicle, accounting for both global pollutants, CO2, and local pollutants that I listed, has a positive environmental benefit. That means if you're in that store and you end up buying an electric car, you generate a benefit to society from reduced air pollution emissions. All right? And as you can see, most of those green places are in the West. Okay. The other colors, the red and the oranges, are places where the gasoline vehicle has less air pollution than the electric vehicle. So if you purchase the electric vehicle, you're actually making air pollution worse, right, than the gas vehicle you would have bought.
The map showed benefits mainly in the West, with negative consequences in the East, Southeast, and Midwest. There's a wide disparity in the electric vehicle's environmental benefit to a community.
In Los Angeles, over the lifetime of the car, you know, we can talk about how we modeled that and assumed 150,000 miles driven, 10-year lifetime. The electric vehicle generates about a $5,000 benefit. Okay? In Fargo, North Dakota, the electric vehicle generates about a negative $5,000 benefit. Okay, so society's $5,000 worse off because you bought the electric car rather than the gas car in Fargo, North Dakota. In New York, it's a bit of a wash. Okay, we have a number, $32, but that's basically trivial.
That's economist Andrew Yates of UNC Chapel Hill. He's discussing the potential benefits of electric vehicles. The forum, the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Why does he see such major differences in the different communities?
Local factors make a big difference when you're talking about local pollution. All right, so Los Angeles has a very large population. So when you drive your gasoline car in Los Angeles, you're affecting a number of people. All right, it's kind of a unique airshed as well because the mountains ring the Los Angeles area and the pollution tends to get stuck in that area. And also, as we'll see, the Western electricity grid is fairly clean. I don't think there's a single coal-powered power plant in the state of California. Now, they get some electricity from other states, but I think that's pretty much true. Fargo, North Dakota is kind of the opposite. When you drive your gasoline car in Fargo, North Dakota, you don't hurt anyone because nobody lives there. Right? On the other hand, when you plug in your electric car, it's powered predominantly by coal. Okay, so it makes sense that that generates a lot of pollution damage, not just in Fargo, North Dakota, right, but in many other places, the way the grid is dispersed and the emissions get dispersed from smokestacks. New York is a wash. It's a large population, but the grid's fairly dirty in the East as well.
Yates reminded the audience that better gas-powered cars already have produced major environmental benefits.
Let's suppose that we have today's fleet of cars driven in today's places, but they were all 1974 cars, polluting like 1974 cars. Right? What would the total damage be due to air pollution? Evaluated by the exact same methodology I just explained. Okay? And so maybe you can see those numbers, but it turns out there'd be about $180 billion worth of damages per year if we had 1974 cars driving around, gasoline cars. Okay? And you can see the graph over time. 2010, maybe I can even use a clicker, we're down to about $40 or $50 billion per year. Right? And you can also see sort of where we started to make progress. There's obviously a lot of changes around this time period in the late 70s, right, and then some other periods in the 80s, and things have been pretty flat over the last decade. Okay, there's been very marginal improvements in miles per gallon, and we're at the point with tailpipe emissions where you get more particulate matter from your tires and brakes than you do from the tailpipe. And you can just think of this as an exponential decline, right? Eventually, at some point, it gets harder and harder to push on this dimension, right? So you can see we've made fairly dramatic improvements by our measures of air pollution damages over the last three or four decades.
Yates also pointed to an important factor called pollution export.
When you drive your car, or in gas or electric, in a given county, the consequences of that driving does not just stay within that county, right? You might affect people farther away, right? Because the pollution might get dispersed into other places. What we've discovered, and it makes sense, but we didn't really think about it before we did the study, is that electric vehicles export pollution to other states. A Ford Focus gas car driven in Fulton County, Georgia. Almost all of that pollution is highly concentrated in three or four counties or five or six counties around where that car is driven. Right? It makes sense. Tailpipe emissions come out at 2 feet, right? So they're very low, and they tend to stick around and harm people right near where the car is driven.
What happens to the pollution picture when you substitute an electric car for a gas-powered car?
You plug that car in, the whole grid, the whole East Coast grid reacts to that change in demand for electricity, right? Those power plants have very high smokestacks. It disperses the pollution. And you can see that Atlanta is green, right? So Atlanta doesn't really suffer the consequences of the pollution from that car, whereas most of that ends up in the Charlotte area in this picture. Okay, but it also has far-reaching consequences throughout the eastern United States.
Yates summarizes his findings.
When you drive your electric car in most states, you're making society worse off, but you're making your state better off. That's kind of the bottom line, because you're sending the pollution somewhere else. Is there an environmental benefit for an electric vehicle? It really depends. It really depends on how clean the grid is, right? The western grid is pretty clean, right? They don't have coal plants. They have hydro. Okay, there's been a lot of changes in the electricity grid just over the last 6 years, so that's going to make electric cars look a little bit better, right? But they have a long way to go in places like Fargo, North Dakota, right, before they generate an environmental benefit. The second point is that they pollute, they export pollution to other places.
That's Andrew Yates, professor in the UNC Chapel Hill Economics Department. He delivered these remarks recently to the John Locke Foundation. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Wake County is growing rapidly, with thousands of people moving into the county each year. That's why the news that the public school system in Wake County added just 42 kids this year really surprised analysts, particularly since Wake voters had just approved a $548 million bond for school construction. So does Wake County's minuscule enrollment growth have implications for the state of North Carolina, perhaps other counties as well? Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He's been following the numbers closely and joins us now. Terry, welcome back and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
All right, so Wake County, all we hear and read is that people are coming in literally every single day. Understandably, it's a great place, as is the entire state, but only 42 kids enrollment growth?
Yeah, it's really shocking considering that their enrollment growth in the past has ranged from anywhere between 1,500 to 6,000 kids. So we've seen tremendous enrollment growth in Wake County in the past. And I think that there was a suspicion, especially amongst those of us who follow these sorts of trends, that there was going to be a slowdown. But this is a slamming on the brakes of student enrollment, which I don't think anyone expected, including Wake County. Before the school year begins, every county provides an estimate of what their enrollment is going to be for the upcoming school year, and it's the basis on which the state gives funding to the school district. They projected a healthy growth of thousands of students, and so they were expecting the kind of influx that they've had in the past. They were caught off guard by only 42 students and are claiming that it's an anomaly.
Does that mean they will be in the position of having to refund money to the state of North Carolina?
Yeah, they will not receive certainly the amount of money they expected to receive. And this is going to be the case with any district that overprojected their enrollment for the upcoming school year, is that they will receive the funding for the students that they have, not for the students that they thought they were going to have. So this is what is, I think, riling a lot of central offices around the state, is that their expectations were so far off the mark that they have to adjust budgets now to compensate for the fact that there are fewer students that are going to come into their district.
Do we know what the dynamics are that led to this?
Well, there are probably multiple factors that are playing a role here. There is a decline in birth rates. We could see that over the last decade, birth rates have been going down. It's the case in Wake County. So that's going to definitely be playing a role. But school choice is definitely playing a role as well. The influx of charter schools, especially in the Triangle, is going to be one factor that's driving some students away from the district system to the charters. And homeschooling is so incredibly popular in Wake County and elsewhere, and there seems to be no slowing the growth in homeschool students around the state, and especially in urban and suburban, but increasingly in rural counties as well. So homeschooling, charter schooling, I think are the two big factors that are leading enrollment estimates to be so far off the mark.
Are we seeing the same trend in other counties?
We definitely are. And you could see all around the Triangle, for example, Durham is going to have a declining student population. We're going to see some of the suburban counties like Johnston and Harnett counties are probably, if they're going to have any increase in students at all, it's going to be very, very small. One thing to keep in mind is the numbers that we're using are the numbers for the second month. And we await enrollment figures for the subsequent months. And at the end of the year, we get that final enrollment number. And a lot changes during the school year. So it's possible that Wake either gains or loses students. The same is true with some of the other districts as well. But it looks like Durham is headed for a year where they're going to have a declining student population.
In the case of Wake County, voters in November approved a $548 million school construction bond, and there had even been talk of perhaps Wake County officials trying to put an additional construction bond on the 2020 ballot.
Mm-hmm.
How do those two things square with 42 new kids?
Well, they really did believe, at least they told everyone they believed, that they were going to get thousands of kids every year for the next decade. And so when you're telling people you have to support this bond because tens of thousands of kids are going to be enrolling in our schools over the next decade, people get worried about having the money for facilities. And so they sold the bond based on the expectation that the enrollment growth that had existed in the county for the last decade was going to continue through the next decade. And of course, that probably isn't going to happen. Now, the good thing about this is they don't need to sell all the bonds at once. In other words, in order for this county to get the money, they sell the bonds. They can spread that out for as long as they need to. So they don't need to use all the money at once or even concentrate the money in the first or second year. But they better not tell voters that they need to approve a bond in 2020. I think voters would understand that if there's a significant slowdown in enrollment, that perhaps they should play catch up with the money they have and not ask voters for additional funds.
That
but anything's
that
possible.
That might be a hard sell, you know, based on those numbers. But we'll see. And as you said, that the numbers could change as we get further into the school year. Terry, there's also been talk, including from key leaders in the General Assembly, of trying to put together some sort of statewide school construction bond. What are your views on that?
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting turn of events because I don't think there were some people, including myself, that really didn't expect there to be a school construction bond presented by Republicans in the General Assembly. It's a tough situation because traditionally the school districts and the counties have been responsible for their facilities, and now the state is looking to take on an increasing role. My thought is that I may be able to support a bond if there's a comprehensive plan for addressing school construction that engages the private sector. But I don't think that that's in place. What I see is a school construction bond that will provide more money for some districts that really do need new school buildings, but not a comprehensive plan for addressing all of the needs that we have in our school facilities. And that's my biggest concern. Is that not just that we have lottery money going to school construction every year and that we might have this possible bond put before voters, which they would approve, but the fact that we don't have a long-term strategy for addressing our facilities. That's my biggest concern, and that's why I'm hesitant to throw any support behind a statewide school construction bond.
When it comes to construction of public charter schools, it's a whole different story. How does a public charter school go about finding a place that they can call a school? Do they get money from the state?
They don't, and they have to look to the private sector if they're building a school, or they have to look for an existing building that could function as a school and provide the funds out of their operating funds to be able to renovate it. So,
and you know this firsthand because you are an operator of a new public charter school.
That's correct. So, you know, we had to get our money from the private sector in order to be in a position to build the school building that will eventually house hundreds of students that will not be a burden on the Wake County schools or the Harnett County schools, given where our school is located, because they will not have to build buildings for the students that come to our school. So we're saving them a lot of money by getting a private sector investor or investors to provide the funds for our school building and take that burden off the local school districts.
Well, the ramifications of all of this is fascinating, and the role that school choice and parents choosing different alternatives to have their children educated. Dr. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. You can read all of his work at carolinajournal.com and johnlocke.org. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Appreciate you listening. Hope you'll come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.